This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. This is a show about ideas, people, and behaviors that are considered inappropriate, out of bounds, or beyond the pale. The things you're not supposed to talk about if you're a school teacher, a college professor, a businessman, a politician, a parent, a neighbor, or even a podcast host. These are the things you're not supposed to say or even think if you're a good liberal, a good conservative, or a good citizen. Each week, I'll interview a person who has something bad to say. They might be a journalist or a professor. They might be a porn star or a drug dealer. They might just be an ordinary person with an ordinary job who doesn't care about the rules of polite society. I'm not interested in breaking the rules just to be a troublemaker. I'm interested in people who break the rules of conventional thought and who expand the scope of what is possible to say in our society. I'm interested in people who make me think. During my lifetime, America media outlets have essentially refused to cover the wars of the United States in the field. They will embed with U.S. troops and cover the wars from the American military's point of view, but never from an independent journalist's point of view. That is until now. I found a young man who has sent himself into the field to cover the conflicts firsthand. And what he has found in his reporting from places like Israel, Gaza, and Russia often confounds the official narratives of the United States government. This is my interview with Jeremy Lofredo. I am joined from New York by someone I wanted to talk to for a long time, Jeremy Lofredo, who, you know, I do say this, I have said this about some journalists who have been on my show, who I say, you know, I think they're doing the best journalism at the time. People like Michael Tracy, Max Blumenthal, people you know and have worked with. But, you know, in an age since Vietnam, I mean, my lifetime, basically, there has been no reporter that I'm aware of who has done what you do. You are, I mean, the old school term would be like foreign correspondent or war correspondent. That doesn't really do it justice what you're up to. But Jeremy, you've been doing reports around the world from Russia, from Israel, from the West Bank, from Paris, from Canada, covering the truckers' convoy. And you have done it from a particular perspective, although I want you to say what that is. But I just want to say out from the front that I've been waiting for you my whole life, man.
It's very nice of you.
I've been waiting for you. I've been waiting for someone who also is intelligent, because like Vice News used to sort of try to do this, but they didn't know what they were talking about. So it was like useless. They would like fly to Yemen and sit around with skateboarders and talk about getting high, which is great. But like you didn't learn anything about Al-Qaeda there. So I've been waiting for some goddamn journalist or somebody to do it. Now you have, and you're very young. You've only been doing this for a few years, right out of college. You've been running around the world. So let's talk first of all. You got kind of big last week because you had a piece for the Gray Zone on this, what do you call it? This ongoing protest by right-wing nationalist settler Israelis. Again, describing them is really tricky there. I want to do that with you too. Like what are the words to describe them? Who are trying to block the aid from coming into Gaza. These are, you know, some of the nicer people you're going to meet. And yes, it got a lot of media attention. I mean, alt media attention, of course. The real, the legacy media is doing its great job of ignoring you. But so you infiltrated them. You infiltrated this group that is protesting the aid trucks trying to stop the aid trucks from coming into Gaza. And why don't you talk about, so first of all, why did you go there? What was this? Was it an assignment? Was it your idea? What was the, like, before you got on the plane to go to Tel Aviv or wherever it was, what were you thinking you were going to do there?
Sure. So in the beginning, so I went there in right after October 7th. I was there the end of October and most of November. And I know that I spoke to Max Blumenthal of the Gray Zone before I went, and he was telling me, you know, he did a field of hate video many, many years ago where he sort of captured the hateful, racist, genocidal ideology that's emanating throughout Israeli society. And he said, you know, now that the war's happening, it would be, it's a great time to go there and talk to people. I said, of course. So I went there and I ended up spending most of my time in the West Bank documenting violence against the Palestinians in the West Bank. And I didn't really get much of the, I didn't really talk to Israelis that often. I spoke to mostly Palestinians who were being subjugated by settlers and the military there. So I came back and then I saw this protest was happening. I said, this is the perfect, this is the perfect time. They're all in one place. All of these, all these people that I would love to talk to that I'd have to search out in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, they're all in this one place. So I thought it'd be a good idea to spend as much time with them as possible and really let them be candid with me and document, because they're actively carrying out the genocidal ideology that they would harbor and that they have and that they would talk about on the street, except they're actually doing it. They're actually stopping food from getting to the, into Gaza actively.
Right.
So I thought, what better place and what better time than right now?
Right. They're literally actively starving people.
Yeah.
So they had like a, the particular way you infiltrated them is they had some bus, they picked people up in the settlements. Is that it?
There's a few like WhatsApp groups that I joined prior to going. Hmm. And I saw that they would say, you know, we're all going to meet at this one little town. And then we're going to take a convoy. All of our private cars are going to go to either Kiryat Shalom or the Nitzana border crossings, depending on which one has more trucks going through that day. Hmm. And the first few days I did do that, I would go with, you know, one of the Israeli activists that I met in the West Bank last trip. And I would go with them there and I was walking around trying to talk to people. And I noticed that the Israeli activists I kept bringing there, because they are, like, you know, anti-Zionists or leftists or whatever you want to describe them as, they are so passionate and understandably so, that they would start, you know, kind of arguing with people.
All right.
And kind of like, that's not what I need right now. I'm trying to, you know, blend in. I'm trying to get these people to be candid with me. And the person I'm with is, you know, arguing about how many people in Gaza are children and, you know, whether they're under occupation or not. It's like, we can't, we're not going to change the minds of these extremist settlers in one argument. It's just not going to happen. This is not what we're here to do. So I started going alone. I was going with the people who don't have cars, the younger people who don't have driver's license. They have a bus that are leaving the metropolitan areas of, you know, Tel Aviv
and
Jerusalem.
No camera operator. You were simply alone. It was just you.
Oh,
and
it was
your
just, it, yeah, yeah. It was just
your
me
phone?
And a camera. It was me. No, I have like a camcorder.
Phone? Yeah, phone. Yeah. Wow. That's it. I mean, yeah. A camera. Yeah. Wow. Okay.
So I just started taking this bus, the shuttle that would leave from Jerusalem at 5:30 a.m. And it was like a great, a Greyhound bus. Like mm-hmm. It was a beautiful big bus.
Mm-hmm.
And in Jerusalem, not that many people would be getting on. And then slowly but surely, as it made its way south through the West Bank, it would be stopping at all these settlements in the West Bank, and kids and adults with their kids would be getting on as if it was a school bus. And, you know, the settlement gate would open. There'd be IDF outside of the gate. The kids would get on, the parents would get on, kids would miss school for it. Parents would not go to work if they worked. And then they drove them down into the Kiryat Shalom border crossing or the Nitzana border crossing. They would all get out and block the humanitarian aid. And just being there every day with them, they would see my face. They were a little confused at first. I don't really speak Hebrew. But after seeing me day after day, they became comfortable with me. And, you know, they would offer me cigarettes and they would offer me beer and they'd want to have conversations with me about other things, not regarding the fact that they're, you know, blocking humanitarian aid, just any conversation about, you know, traveling or about sports. And so, like, they truly began to be candid with me. And you saw in the video, they yeah. ended up admitting some wild things.
Yeah. So I guess people might not be clear. What it became is a documentary. Was about 10 to 15 minute documentary.
Yeah, it was a 17 minute
video on YouTube and Rumble Gray Zone. Just go to the Gray Zone channel and you'll see it there. And the reason it got so much attention is that there are multiple highlights in it of these protesters. Again, I want to come up with a name in a second with you for what to call them, because I'm not clear about that. But admitting to many things. So you have, I guess, maybe the top story is that you have an actual reservist from the IDF who was in Gaza, and he talks about destroying private homes and mosques and a UN building that was sheltering people. And he says this very matter-of-factly. You have a settler from Staten Island, right? Is she from New York?
Staten Island or Long Island? I can't remember, but definitely.
Yeah, So you have this woman with a very New York accent, who's an Israeli settler, talking about how they're making plans, very extensive, detailed plans for resettling Gaza, for taking over parts of Gaza or all of it. And she's very excited about it and very enthusiastic about it. And of course, this is what God intends, that God intends us to have that land, et cetera, et cetera. I don't want to, you know, spoil this too much, because I want people to see this video. It's absolutely essential. But you see that these people are, of course, completely committed to what we're calling ethnic cleansing and genocide. And I mean, I would say certainly at least ethnic cleansing. They make no bones about that. They want to move every single Gazan out of Gaza and take it over. And there's no doubt. Then you also show the IDF soldiers helping them do this stuff and sort of protecting them and taking care of them and giving them snacks and drinks and stuff to keep them refreshed during their protest. So first of all, what do you want to call these people? I hate using the word extremist to describe anybody, because of course you and I get called extremist by most of society. So what would you call them?
Yeah, I mean, the word extremist doesn't really work that well, because I mean, unless you consider the Israeli state extremist, because the Israeli state policy wise is totally on board with these extremists. So and protesters, they're really not protesting anything, because, or at least from their own government, because the IDF, as a matter of policy, supports these protesters. Mm-hmm. So I they are, you know, acting as foot soldiers of Israeli policy, and they understand that. They, if you watch the video, they explain, you know, the government is in a tight spot. If they don't let the aid in, there will be political backlash, and we might not get the weapons we want from the West. So we need to step in, and we can block the aid, and it won't get blamed on the government. It will be blamed on the citizens, and we're fine with that. We just need to make sure the aid doesn't go through. The government wants us here. Obviously, the military wants us here, but they can't do that themselves, or else there'll be political backlash. So we are acting, we are protecting them from the political backlash of not letting the aid in by doing it ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, but they're saying that the long goal, the big objective for them is to move people out. They don't even really talk much about self-defense or protecting themselves from Hamas.
No, yeah, they're protecting the government, the Israeli government, from the political backlash of not letting aid in. They are not letting aid in because they want the people in Gaza to starve, and they think that would be the quickest way to depopulate Gaza and resettle Gaza, is if they not only get bombed constantly, they also, there's mass famine.
So, yeah, I mean, and the way they talk about it, as I said, with the woman from New York, the Israeli settler from New York, talking about how it's, you know, God intends us to live here in Gaza. This is what that's why we're doing it. And that is standard for, as far as I can see from some of your videos. And I mean, everything I've seen from settlers, that's all they say. That's the only argument they make, is that land is ours because of God. Mm-hmm. So sounds to me like the only word to describe them is Zionist.
Yeah, they're right? They're just Zionist. I mean, when I'm speaking in real life with somebody, I will use the word protesters, but I'll throw the air quotes in there, because they call themselves protesters. They are, you know, it is a protest against what's happening, but it just so happens to be that their protest aligns perfectly with the policies of the Israeli military.
So extremist, think, is a very bad idea to call them that, for a few reasons, right?
Yes.
And I think because it obfuscates what Zionism is. So these people, I think they're being absolutely true to the ideology. You can maybe call them especially aggressive Zionists, but Zionists, to a person, believe that long land belongs to them because it's in the Bible. And so it's just been a debate for 75 years among Israelis about how to do that. And that's all. That's the debate. But
Their ideas are very mainstream. To call them extremist sort of lets all other Zionists off the hook.
Yeah. So you spent quite a bit of time in Israel. That's the next question. Clearly, they are consistent with much of Israeli government. Their views are consistent with many, obviously, members of the Israeli government, but maybe the government as a whole right now. They're consistent with, I think, settlers in general, the 700 or 800,000 settlers in Israel who are generally speak that way. Mm-hmm. How about the rest of Israeli society? Did you get a sense? I mean, how are these people really outliers? Are they looked down upon? Do people think, are Israelis embarrassed by these lunatics trying to stop aid to children or not? Did you get a sense of that?
I would say that most of Israeli society, actually, I was in Jerusalem, I was in Tel Aviv, you know, like the parts of Israeli society that would consider themselves, you know, liberal, maybe they work in the arts, they're in college, they went to college. They do think that the people that are blocking the aid at the border make them look bad. But then when you really get down to it, they agree that no aid should be going into Gaza because it's all going to go to the terrorists and that it's going to make our enemy stronger. So like they don't like the bad reputation, but it fits them perfectly well because they agree with everything they're doing. They just don't like to be called right wing. They don't like to be called right wing because they like to think of themselves as a liberal.
Yeah,
but they're not that.
This is the ultimate crisis of what's been called liberal Zionism.
There's no such thing.
Which is mostly, you know, American Zionists tend to try to be liberal Zionists and try to sort of pretend that it can be a liberal project. So Eli Lake said on Twitter the other day, and I immediately shot back at him based on your video. In fact, I said, he said, you know, listen, no one wanted this to happen. The killing of the aid workers, the seven aid workers, World Central Kitchen. Right. And he said, listen, no one wanted this to happen. It's a horrible tragedy. Don't pretend that anybody in Israel would want this to happen. And I said, well, what about the people protesting, trying to block the aid trucks from coming in? Are they not reflective of Israeli society generally? He didn't answer me.
Of course, not even that. I saw that, you know, Netanyahu, after this happened, said, you know, Israel is fully in agreement that aid should be going into Gaza and we should be feeding the Palestinians in Gaza, et cetera, et cetera. But when you watch the video, you see that it's a matter of policy that aid should not be going into Gaza, that the military is supporting the people who are blocking aid. So it's not just those people at the border. It's not just the civilians. It is the IDF as a whole. And surely that these IDF soldiers at the border are not just doing this on their own. They're getting orders from their boss and their boss's boss to allow these protesters to illegally be in this closed military zone. These people should be swiftly removed, arrested, but the military is guiding them to the gate and then using the protesters being there as justification for closing all aid crossings. So yeah. it's a matter of Israeli policy that as little aid as possible gets into Gaza. So killing some aid workers that is so aid doesn't go into Gaza is perfectly in line with what the military has been doing for weeks and weeks at the borders of Gaza and Israel.
Right. Yeah. So I'm going to use a stupid word. Like, what was the vibe that you picked up when you got to, so you'd already been basically in Palestine and West Bank before this, right? So you're kind of more used to that. And then you were in Israel, Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. I mean, Jesus, man, it looks from the outside, at least increasingly, like a nation comprised largely, mostly of people who are interested in genicide. Like, I mean, is that what you pick up? I mean, is it like when you're walking through the streets in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem?
That's the vibe. For
damn.
Sure. That's the vibe. Like, I'll be at a pub and I will be speaking to, you know, people in college or graduated college or art students, and everything they say will be very liberal. And then, you know, a couple of drinks in, they'll be talking about how, you know, how they just don't like Arabs. They just don't get them. They just don't like Arabs. They just don't get along with Arabs. And so it's everywhere. It's in the leftists are talking about this. The people who consider themselves leftist, at least, are speaking about Arabs like they're not human. And that's just a mainstream conversational thing that you would hear at the pub by an art student, by anybody. And it's, and when I went there, and Max Blumenthal told me this, he said, you know, the settlers are they're the happiest people in Israeli society. They're the happiest people. They have no qualms about genocide or ethnic cleansing. They're just happy all the time. And I was like, okay, that's interesting. And that's exactly what I experienced, because I'm with the Palestinians in the West Bank, and a settler drives by, or we drive by with Palestinians past a settlement, and they look away. They're frightened beyond belief just being in the vicinity of settlers or settlements. And now I'm on one of these buses going into the settlements and hanging out with these settlers. And I'm noticing that they are there. I mean, they're blocking humanitarian aid. They are trying to manufacture famine conditions in Gaza. And they're bringing Heinekens to the border at 11 a.m. They're partying. They have no qualms. They're so unbelievably happy. And so it's just such a strange, scary vibe. These people are genocidal, but they're not, at least amongst each other, when they think that they're amongst each other. They're, you know, they're drinking at 11 a.m. They're cooking at the border of what the UN Secretary General called a graveyard for children. They have no qualms about genocide. They're unbelievably happy, happier than these supposedly, you know, liberal Zionists or these leftists in Israel that say, you know, I don't think that they should have, you know, full rights, the Palestinians. They do want to kill us, but I'm anti-Zionist because this and that. Like, when they're talking over themselves back and forth, they don't make any sense. At least the settlers make total, complete, full sense in the way that they're like, well, no, we don't think that they should exist. Like, point blank, at least they're being clear with their intentions.
Oh, yeah.
Unlike most of Israeli society.
Oh, yeah. No, I love hearing from settlers. Yeah, they're very, very direct and honest all the time. Whoa, this thing about them being the happiest people in Israel, which, by the way, is known as a fairly happy country, oddly. But it is, I mean, it is known, I think, for good reason, as a sort of a one giant party town, especially Tel Aviv. And there,
yeah,
I see a lot of stuff that's really enviable. Like, I see a lot of sort of life for Israeli Jews is pretty damn good. But that the settlers, and I've caught that vibe from them of being quite exuberant about what they're up to and their lives, and they're very happy about where they are. Gosh, you know, but they're armed to the teeth. They teach their kids to shoot automatic rifles at an early age. They're basically always at war. I mean, they're.
Oh yeah. For the settlers in the West Bank, there's no time when they're not at war, because their whole point to be in the West Bank is to ethnically cleanse and kick the Palestinians out from villages surrounding the settlement. So they're never not at war so long as they're Palestinians still in the West Bank.
I'm going to say something kind of strange, but I think it's just a testament to the power of community. I mean, I think, you know, because yeah, they're
surely.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, their community is very, very tight and strong, very cohesive, seems to be, for various external reasons, right? They're sort of forced into it. And I can imagine, you know, there's a lot of benefits to that. Like, same with Orthodox Jews. You see, like, the Hasidim in New York. I mean, they have this really, from the outside, it looks like craziness and weirdness, and no one would want to do that. But there's a lot of nurturing that goes on within the community.
Imagine. It's a very tiny community. I grew up in Toms River, New Jersey, which is right next to Lakewood, New Jersey, which is like the biggest population of Orthodox Jews outside of Israel, including Brooklyn. And you know, we would, you know, drive by. It's right left. What is it? West of Toms River, and you know, we see them walking around on the Sabbath, or they would knock on our door, ask for Tylenol because they can't go to the store after sundown, et cetera, et cetera. The kids become lawyers or doctors, and they move back to the community. It's very tight knit. They all buy things off each other. They all go to each other's businesses. It's the aim of any community, how tight knit they are. Truly.
Common enemy yeah, brings them together as well, you know. Everybody on September 12th loved George Bush suddenly.
Yeah,
everybody exactly. Everybody was an American suddenly. Mm-hmm. Everybody loved America and cared about America on September. Everybody, all the every lefty I knew was all about that. So it makes sense. So yeah, that's fascinating. So yeah, everyone, please go watch this video. Gray Zone. I forget the title of it, but you'll find it. And then before that, you were in the West Bank. And again, great series of reports showing what is really going on there, which in many ways, in some ways, you could argue is sort of worse in some strange ways. I mean, it's more sort of, I think Gaza is more sort of brutal and authoritarian, the regime, what it's doing there, whereas West Bank is more an attempt, at least, at being totalitarian with, you know, obviously the IDF soldiers in it and policing it, et cetera. We don't have to get into that, but what, yeah. And then actually, you know what, here's a question I have for you. I have seen and heard many reports of Palestinians being an especially generous and welcoming people, that they just, you walk into some Palestinian village anywhere, like in the West Bank or wherever, and they will invite you into their home sort of almost automatically. Which I've not said this publicly until right now, because I don't want to ever be like, you know, the noble savage, and we must uplift the, you know, the brown people are so good versus us. but I mean, I've seen quite a bit of evidence of that. And then we could talk about the Israeli personality, which might be a little bit different. But you know, is that just some stereotype that like that college students wearing keffiyehs at Yale made up, or is that real?
I mean, I am an American, but also I was invited into all these Palestinian villages and homes with the understanding that I was there to, you know, interview them and share the problems that they're going through. But with you know, I am American, but I am there, you know, for good. But I was invited into all these places, all these villages. Not one. I was probably in 20 different villages in the West Bank, and every single time I was invited into a village, whether it's a tent because they were, you know, recently ethnically cleansed from their actual neighborhood or still a village, I was offered coffee and sweets. And if I was there for dinner, I was given dinner. If I was there for breakfast, I was given breakfast. It came to a point where one day I went into, you know, let's say 5 different villages to talk to different people. And by the 5th one, they tried to give me a cup of coffee. And I was like, I'm still jittering from like the last one. I'm like, thank you, truly thank you. But I couldn't walk into any Palestinian home without being given something to eat and tea with a lot of sugar or coffee. So what you're saying is definitely my experience.
Well, you know, the Palestine Solidarity Movement, which is sort of called in left-wing circles, mm-hmm. you know, has been around since the 60s, 70s. And it's been especially intense. I mean, among all the left-wing causes, it might be the most intense. I mean, people commit their entire lives to this, you know, and there have been American activists who have died doing this. You know, Rachel Corrie is just one Western activist. And I have suspected for a while that that might be one of the main reasons for that intensity, because of the way the Palestinians are and the way that they treat people who are outsiders, especially Westerners, especially Americans whose country is responsible for their misery.
It wasn't just me, you know, I would be traveling to these places with Israeli activists who these Israeli activists became more active post October 7th, because post October 7th, just to give you a little background.
Yeah.
Israel turned all the settlers in the West Bank into military reservists.
Yes.
So all the settlers were given, you know, green uniforms, long guns, sometimes jeeps, drones, and they used these, you know, they were emboldened by the war, and they knew that nobody, especially the military or the police, who would normally sometimes, you know, at least tell the settlers to, like, you know, get lost or get out of here. No one was going to protect Palestinians post October 7th. So they took this as an opportunity to ethnically cleanse as many villages as they could. And so the Israeli activists, a lot of them were, you know, a lot of the ones who were going to the West Bank before October 7th were a little too scared to do it post-war, because they knew how violent the settlers and the military would be if they were caught helping Palestinians. Mm-hmm. But there were some who were going to the West Bank every day. And these Israeli activists were welcome just like I was. These are Israelis. They have an Israeli passport. They're going to leave the West Bank and go back to their, you know, cushy neighborhood in Jerusalem. And still, the Palestinians have no one to help them. Still, they would welcome these Israelis into their home and feed them like they fed me. And, you know, give them dinner, even when they didn't have enough food for dinner, give them dinner and coffee and tea and make sure that they were okay and give them a comfortable place to sleep because the settlers are less likely to be super violent against the Palestinians if there are Israeli activists sleeping in these villages. So it wasn't just an American, it was also Israelis that they were being nice to, which is really hard to wrap your head around.
I've heard that many times. Yeah, even in Gaza, I've heard that happening.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, so given what you now know about Israeli society, the mood in Israel, the political tenor in Israel, what do you say about people who claim that there's no way they would deliberately kill seven humanitarian aid workers?
Yeah, I mean, it's like it's similar to the Boeing whistleblower who was recently killed.
Yeah.
It's like obviously Boeing would kill someone. They kill people in other countries every single day. So like it's like why would Israel not kill a few humanitarian aid workers when we're seeing them every day murdering hundreds of people and not allowing aid in? So it's like it's they don't mind killing people because we see that very often, and they don't mind obstructing aid from Palestinians because they're doing that as we speak. So I don't see how it's a very believable story, the fact that they would kill humanitarian aid workers.
Yeah. Also, do you know the number on this? I haven't gotten hard numbers, but I think it's the percentage of the IDF that is made up of settlers.
That's a great number to know. I don't know it.
Big chunk. I think it's at least 20%. It's growing. That's the big point to make. So settlers, I wouldn't put it past most of them either. I mean, so if they were, if whoever was pushing the button, if they were from some village in the West Bank,
Of course.
I of course they would. Of course they would. They think those people are their mortal enemies just as much as Hamas is. Well, so just about your trip to Israel and in general in the West Bank. I mean, young guy, incredible adventure on one level. Like, I want to kind of hear how you felt about it just personally. Like, what was this like? I mean, it's something I wish I had done. I wish I could have done it. I would love to do something like what you're doing. I wish I had done it when I was your age. It must have been quite, I mean, obviously you're sort of reporting on horrors and, you know, the some of the worst things ever in our lifetime, but I would imagine just for you personally, it must have been quite an experience.
Yeah, the initial trip was only supposed to be 10 days. I ended up staying there for a little more than a month,
Wow.
because I would be going to these Palestinian villages in the West Bank, and each one would tell me the settlers came in, they kidnapped my son yesterday. They brought him to the settlement. They told us that we have 24 hours to leave. We don't know where to go. Stories like this over and over and over, and I noticed. I was like, wait a second. There's not one other journalist. All these towns, there's not one journalist. Where
Amazing.
is everyone? So I thought to myself, if no one is coming here to talk to these people, let's stay here. Let's keep going. Let's go south. Let's go north. Let's go to as many villages as we can go to. One village in Taibeh, which is like the largest Christian community in the West Bank. They aren't. It's different from America because it's not. They make lots of money from selling olive oil and beer. They have tons of olive trees, but in America, if you are rich, if you have money, you're less likely to be persecuted by other people or the state, et cetera, but in Taipei, they have a beautiful little village, and they make enough money. Everyone shares the profits from their olive oil and their beer. Their cars are taken every day by settlers who literally came here from France 3 years ago.
Right.
Their olive trees are chopped down.
Right.
All of their machinery and the things that they use to, grow their olives and make their oil is sabotaged by settlers on a daily basis. And the state protects the settlers, of course, but it's just interesting to see a community that is, economically pretty healthy. And all these people are pretty well off. But even having money doesn't stop you from being attacked by the Israeli military or settlers, et cetera, et cetera.
So the political import of what you're doing, I want to get to that, and then I want to move on to Russia. So I mean, I think everyone would agree, pretty much, except for the most delusional Zionists, that if the United States ceases supporting Israel in every way, you know, is an entirely new ball game. I don't know exactly what would happen, but it's a whole new ball game. I think Palestine would be free is the main thing if the U.S. stops supporting Israel. So I think a lot of us over here on the Palestine solidarity movement kind of miss the main point to be making, which is simply that we just need to be making the argument the United States should stop supporting that thing. I don't think we do enough of that. I think we should just focus our arguments on that. Why should give me an argument for why my tax dollar should go to that? And I think that maybe the best tool to convince normie average Americans about this is footage of Israeli settlers. Just let them see those people. That's all they need to know. Tell them how many there are.
That's what he's going to.
Exactly. So that's what you're doing, man. Like you're getting, I mean, if the regular media ever picked it up, the game would be over. I think if they ever picked up your stuff, if your videos were ever on MSNBC or CNN, game over for Israel. I do believe, honestly, I think it'd be that quick because that just discredits the entire project so immediately.
And even the right wing in America, the conservative, economically conservative right wing, they need to understand that the settlers in the West Bank are completely subsidized by the state.
Totally.
They don't work. Their houses are built by construction companies and development companies that are paid for by Israel. Israel sends them electricity, water, pays for their security, and they don't have to work. Their entire lives are subsidized by the state. Their only goal is to expand and grow and kick people off their land who own their land. So I think they're doing exactly what the economic right in America would say is immoral. You're stealing money from the state, you're, you know, et cetera, stealing money from the stealing tax dollars.
Yeah.
That's their whole life. That's the settler's life.
Oh yeah. I personally know many libertarians, self-described libertarians who are pro-Israel, pro-settlement, the whole thing. It's just, I don't get it. But yeah, the good news is that a lot of the right is not that way. I mean, it's a very different landscape now. Thank God. It's a very different thing about Israel. All right. I do want to talk about your work in Russia because it's phenomenal. And like in some ways, it's even better, I think, than what you did with Israel, as important as that is. So you worked for Rebel News. Doing your first report, you went to Russia, you went to Moscow, and you were sent there by Rebel News, which is, for people who don't know, it's, I guess, you could call it a nationalist pop, the biggest sort of nationalist populist media outlet in Canada. You could call it like the MAGA media outlet of Canada. Is that fair? I mean,
it is fair.
Okay.
I will say, in fairness, when I began working for them, I only knew their work because of the Canadian trucker convoy. I truly did not know who they were. I read their Wikipedia page. I was like, that's interesting.
Oh, really?
There's a lot of stuff about them. But I've never heard any of this. I didn't know who they were because that wasn't really my space. You know,
right.
I'm not even familiar really with the Breitbart in America, let alone a Breitbart in Canada.
Right.
So when I did this, I followed the American trucker convoy for Rebel News.
Because so people know, you're basically a lefty. That's,
yes, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. So you're, and these guys are very right wing.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
But thankfully, Joe Biden was president when I was working for Rebel News. So, and still is obviously, but I would be able to, you know, criticize the US government as long as I call it the Biden administration. They're not really, they're truly, they don't understand. I'm making a critique about the U.S. military apparatus as long as I call it Biden's military. You know, it's you have to be careful with your words there. I noticed, but
they're a little partisan, is what you're saying.
Yeah, no, truly, very very partisan, very partisan. And it was so during COVID, it was great to work there because it was the only place where I could get paid for talking about the COVID vaccines, the lockdowns, the effects that lockdowns are having on the global South. But as soon as COVID started to not become as important anymore, Russia became a little more important, the war in Russia and Ukraine.
Yeah.
So that gave me another, I could talk about this. They don't mind because it's Biden's policy that's doing these things.
Oh.
So it gave me a little bit of more time to work with them. But after that, I decided to.
Well, that's funny because I did notice that Ezra Levant, who's the editor at Rebel News, he had a whole video just explaining to the audience why they sent this kid to Moscow.
Yes, he was so unbelievably afraid of being accused of being, you know, a Russian shill paid by Putin. He actually had me record a video. He was so scared. He truly is. It's not fake. He actually is scared of Russia. no, like it's not like he made me record a video before I left for Moscow. And he had me look at the camera, and because he was already planning to make money and crowdfund if I was to get arrested. So he had me look at the camera and say, "My name is Jeremy Lofredo, and if you're watching this, something horrible has happened." So it was as if I was getting arrested. He wanted to have a video ready. Yeah,
Do you have that video clip somewhere?
I don't have that video clip. No.
Well, I mean, you should have told him, you know, I'm not planning on trying to get into a military facility.
Of course.
Which is what the Wall Street Journal guy was doing. But
yeah, it was like everyone there, because they truly are, they are neocons. So hearing that one of their correspondents or reporters wants to go to Russia, they're thinking like, that is the most dangerous thing I've ever heard. And I know, I used to work for RT. I know what Russia is. I know what this war is. I know how they would treat me. I know I'm not scared of going to Moscow. It's one of the most beautiful cities in the world.
Right.
But I had to deal with, you know, a team of managers that were deathly afraid of me entering the Russian state.
Right. Right. I was in Moscow in 1987. And it was fine. And it was fine. That was fine then. Soviet soldiers at the border. We had to go through the whole like phalanx of Soviet soldiers to get through the airport. So let's talk about this, man. You did some amazing reporting. You just get off the plane. You go to the local supermarket in Moscow. Sort of this is Tucker before Tucker did his thing.
Yes. Yes.
And all the, which I don't think you got credit for, by the way, or the blame. I don't know, because all of the blowback against Tucker Carlson's thing about the Russian supermarket, like, because I had been seeing your piece. You're not the only one, by the way. There are many people who have just sort of taken a camera into like Russian supermarkets in Moscow, yeah. And they look amazing. And it's like again and again, I've seen many of the many shots of video of like just the streets in Moscow. And it looks like what you showed, which is that prices are pretty low and the goods are really good and it's very nice. And well, tell me, like, what did it seem like?
There was like the week before I went, there was an Atlantic piece, a New York Times piece, Washington Post. They're all saying, you know, Soviet style shortages, essential good crisis, like these type of phrases. So I said, let's go to a few markets, and I'll go to a few markets, and we'll just take a video of me shopping, and you know, I'll pick things out. I'll show the various cheeses and meats and breads they have, fresh baked breads, meats, like they have steak, filet mignon, chicken, pork, they have rabbit, like they have way more meat than you would find at, you know, the Whole Foods here in Manhattan.
Oh yeah.
Wow. Yeah, for sure. It was really impressive. And it came to I can't remember the exact price, but I got, you know, a week's worth of groceries for like $18.
Wow.
No, it was outrageous. Wow. And Tucker actually, I don't know if you remember, but Tucker invited me on the show to talk about that.
Oh yeah, right.
So he invited me on the show. So he clearly has seen it, because he invited me on the show to talk about it. And then he did it himself.
That's right. He stole it. He stole your shit. That's funny. So yeah, I mean, so you showed basically what he showed. And again, it's incredible that people were like laughing at Tucker as if it's just ridiculous to say that the grocery stores in Moscow are nice. But so you found that during the sanctions, and you know, it turns out that there is, I mean, okay. So here's the political import of that little report you did from the fucking grocery store, man. What it did was, you know what it did? It showed that the multipolar world is a real thing. Because it showed that the United States, if it decides to go against you, it can't necessarily shut you down anymore.
No, yeah. The time that the entire Western world is enforcing sanctions on a scale never seen before
Right.
It doesn't affect your country.
If anything,
it makes you stronger because you begin to focus on producing things domestically. So
and with other partners and with China,
yes, sir,
and whoever, right? So that's what you did right there. You showed to the people of the world, not just Russia, that you can go against the United States and still eat well.
Mm-hmm, of course.
That was not possible 20 years ago. Not possible. That's a big deal. So it's not a pro-Putin, pro-Russia thing, everybody. It's simply an argument for a multipolar world, ultimately, which don't we all want that? So then you go on the street, and to me, this was just the best thing in the world, because who was it? One of the big shots. It was like Bill Kristol or Timothy Snyder or one of the top like public intellectual pro-Ukraine, anti-Russia intellectuals saying, well, of course, in Russia, if you even mention a word against the Ukraine war, you get scooped up off the streets and thrown into a gulag. Okay, well, that's what you did. You went on the streets and you asked just random Russians on the streets of Moscow, what do you think of the war? And about half of them were opposed to it.
For sure. And it wasn't even, they weren't just opposed to it. They weren't whispering to me that they were opposed to it.
Yeah.
These are people who were yelling on the streets of Moscow had they opposed the war. This is, I thought there was no freedom of speech. I thought that this would get you thrown in jail, of course. These are young people yelling about how they don't support the war in Ukraine. So like this just, not only does this show the opinions of people in Russia, this also shows that you're allowed to say something like that in Russia.
Right. So I want to clarify sort of what I understand to be happening in Russia around these things is that Putin has absolutely put media people in jail. He has absolutely forcibly shut down media outlets of all kinds, for sure. As I understand it, though, in every case or damn near every case, those outlets and journalists were working with the United States or the United Kingdom.
Surely.
I mean, so not these people you were talking to on the streets. They weren't working with foreigners. So why would Putin put them in prison? I mean, it's quite impressive what you showed there. Again, this was a Rebel News, right? That was a Rebel News.
This is with Rebel News, yeah.
Yeah, everyone, please go watch that one. That is like one of the best pieces of, maybe the best piece of reporting on the entire war, I thought, honestly. And then the other thing you did, and this was you did it sort of both for Rebel News and Gray Zone. There was this huge so-called scandal about a year ago, year and a half ago, allegedly that Russia was kidnapping all of Ukraine's children and putting them in concentration camps where they were re-educated inside Russia. And this was considered to be one of the worst war crimes of the war and further evidence that Putin is Hitler times 10. So you actually went, and this was sort of accidental, right? You didn't even plan on going to one of those.
Totally accidental. Yeah.
On your first trip there, you went to it. And then when this became a story, you sort of made it into a piece in which you showed what's really going on at one of these youth camps,
exactly.
Which was called the Donbass Express. Bring kids from the Donbass, the war zone, which has been a war zone since 2014, and teach them music. At least that's allegedly what goes on there. And you'd have this long interview with the director, I think, or one of the directors of the camp, who's an amazing guy. And like his whole critique, I thought was pretty spot on too, by the way.
Very politically aware, smart guy who is also a professional violinist.
Yeah, exactly. And so you found no evidence that it was a concentration camp of that kind.
I never thought in a million years that this could be called a concentration camp. Like I never thought that this would be made into anything by the State Department. I just went there. I was with my fixer, whose wife is a pretty accomplished musician in Russia. And he said, listen, we don't have anything planned today. If you want, we can go to a hotel about an hour away where they're housing people from the front line, from Donbass, and they're teaching them music and they're allowing them to learn music and chorus. And, you know, it might be a fun experience. I said, for sure, let's go. And I went there. I spoke to the kids, I ate with them, I spoke to the directors, I watched them perform a concert. And then actually, I tried to make this a report for Rebel News as soon as I got back.
Oh.
And management at Rebel News said, you know, this school is funded by the Russian state and you were there, so it makes us look like we are working with Russia. So I know the kids, like, I know this is good stories coming from the kids coming from the war zone, et cetera, but let's not put it out because it looks like we are with Russia. I said, it's fine, sure. Months later, Max Blumenthal calls me and says, look at the State Department accusing Russia, blah, 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 accusing these schools of being
Yeah.
concentration camps. And I said, I've been to one. I've been to one, and I have footage from the, I have interviews. And so we turned it into a report after the place, the malevolent music school was accused of being a evidence of war crimes.
Yeah. I mean, it sure looked like, again, I don't know for sure, but I sure didn't. The way they talked about it, also the fact that the way the director of the school talked was not propagandistic at all. In fact, if I were Putin, I would probably wish he said things differently.
Yeah.
He wasn't comporting exactly with what the government wants there. So, and then you talk to one of the kids. Now, I did see a little bit in one of the kids talking. There was a couple little phrases that were a little propagandistic, but again, like, kids are taught stuff in public schools all the time that comes out like that, so who knows? But yeah, I mean, it looks like they're teaching kids how to play music. Kids love it because they were living in the Donbass, which was, they're getting bombed for years, and now they get to play music in Moscow.
Yeah, no, it was great for them. I mean, they are, they're watch the interviews. They're speaking Russian. They're speaking Russian songs. There's Russian phrases, Russian food. They see themselves as Russian. For sure they do.
Yeah, I mean, right.
So and not only do they see themselves as Russian and speak Russian, but they are under military bombardment. So of course they would love to go to Moscow and sing and play the piano for a little
Right. Yeah, the whole
while.
idea that they're being re-educated into good Russian citizens is also ridiculous. If you know anything about the Donbass, I mean, I think this is pretty much universally recognized that the vast majority of people in the Donbass have identified as Russian.
Of
And
course.
so there was no need to re-educate them, and they speak Russian for to begin with. Well, so yeah, I can't believe what you're doing, and it's amazing. I wanted to just ask you sort of what your, yeah, I didn't guess you didn't really answer this, or I maybe didn't ask it. Like, why did you start doing this at the, when you were like all of 22 years old or whatever? Did you want to become like a war correspondent, a foreign correspondent? I did. Was that your wish early on?
I wanted to do something like this. Yeah, definitely. I was when I was at RT, I was just producing a show, and I was thinking, like, this is not, I'm kind of sitting at a computer. I'm organizing information. I'm reaching out to experts who can talk about the things that I want to talk about, but I want to hit the road. I want to start doing my own thing, and I did in due time.
You're like, I mean, you are. Aren't you basically the only reporter? I guess Clarissa Ward has been in Gaza for
Yeah, I
CNN.
actually met her.
Did you? Oh,
Yeah,
wow.
she I met her. She was at the aid pro like at the aid protest, the blocking for one day, and I met her there
And?
and her team of 8 people.
Oh, really? And
She
what do you think about her?
was very nice to me. I mean,
Yeah.
I've heard people say that they don't like this person, that this person does this, and I only spoke to her for maybe 5 minutes, and I watched her walk around all day. She seemed like a nice lady.
She, I mean, it's not her fault. She doesn't know better. She doesn't know what she's
Yeah,
doing.
no, of course.
Yeah. So, I mean, you're just like the only reporter, you're the only journalist doing this stuff. I mean, no one went to Russia, no one went to Ukraine, no one did any of this. It's amazing. Do you want to keep doing this? Is it dangerous? Are you afraid? What do your parents think?
My father, I spoke to him on the phone the first time when I was in Israel the first time in November, and he's like, "Is it okay?" I'm like, "It's beautiful. It's Tel Aviv. It's a beautiful city. Like, it's
Right.
fine." And then a missile siren comes on, and I say,
Oh,
"Oh, an ambulance is coming. I have to go." And
shit.
so because I don't want these people to worry. It's my father, but he's fine as long as as long as my family knows I'm safe. Like, I mean, I think if I feel safe, they're fine, and
Yeah.
I do want to keep doing it at least for now. I know that, like, when I have a family, like, yes, traveling often all around the world into dangerous places is probably not the most responsible thing to do. But for now, I definitely want to keep doing it. Yeah.
How about going inside Gaza if you can?
Well, I was technically inside Gaza, with the settlers.
Oh.
So the settlers, they organized a march from Sirot, which is like a mile away from the Erez border crossing. And they organized a march. And that's when I spoke to these settlers who want to resettle in Gaza. They said, we're going to go into Gaza. So they brought wood, they brought drills, they brought saws, and the military allowed them to cross the Erez border crossing into Gaza. They went about 100 meters into Gaza, and they built these symbolic outposts to, you know, symbolically show that they are going to come back into Gaza. They're going to build their houses just like they're building this little shed. And even then I was seeing, you know, signs that says, you know, watch out, you're in a Israeli military sniper zone. But you know, I'm with these settlers who are above the law essentially. So I don't think anything bad is going to happen to me, but, going into Gaza right now, truly not something I'd want to do. Just seeing how carelessly they just bomb entire neighborhoods. Like, I don't want to,
and kill 100 journalists.
Yeah, no, truly. Exactly. It's whether it's on accident or on purpose, it's not something I want to get near.
Yeah, normally I would say yes, please go, but no, I don't want you to go there right now. But when it as soon as it's open, I mean, I want to go. But
No, I would love to go. It's just not right now. I mean, I was
sure
in there with the settlers, and it's funny because being with the settlers does afford you. It's selfish, and it's immoral, but it does afford you a sense of security because you're with these people that. The military does not touch. The military sees these people as above the law. So as long as you're traveling with them, you're fine because they can do no wrong in the Israeli state's eyes.
Yeah. Wow. So where do you want to go next? What do you want to do?
Yeah, I have a few videos coming still from my first trip. From the last trip.
Awesome.
I spent some time. In the Armenian quarter, in the old city, the Armenian Church of Jerusalem has been under attack by settlers and a Israeli company that wants to build a luxury hotel and take over the Armenian quarter. So I spent some time in the Armenian quarter. If you actually look on Twitter, you can find it. Just yesterday, settlers came and attacked the Armenians and tried to destroy their property and attack clergymen. And so I think the Christian right or the conservative right in America needs to see that just like they saw, just like how I showed how the Israeli state will attack Christian Palestinians in the West Bank, just like they'll attack Muslims. They don't see any difference between someone who's not Jewish and not Jewish. They're doing the same thing to the Christians in Jerusalem. And like these are people who are going to church with a cross, just like the Christians here. So I think that has the power to kind of turn these Zionist Christians in America, you know, maybe against Israel a little bit.
I think so too. The more Americans see your stuff, the closer we're going to be to peace. And I think a free Palestine, I mean it. So you're technically independent, right? You're freelance.
Mm-hmm.
You're not staff on anybody. Okay. Yeah. Well, everybody, please go. Go find Jeremy's work, Jeremy Lofredo at The Gray Zone, Rebel News, wherever, man. It's just amazing what you're doing. It's essential journalism. So thank you for what you're doing. Stay safe. Keep going.
Thank you so much.
All right, man. Thank you. This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. To become a patron of the show and have access to bonus episodes, AMAs, and the unreported news analysis show, go to patreon.com/unregistered. Thanks for listening.